Okay, we could open it up for more another Q&A session if anybody has any questions.
Hi there. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the practice of cultivating patience. While I was sitting for 45 minutes in the afternoon and sometimes in the evening, that's a kind of a lesson in patience for me because it's kind of tough. So just some thoughts about cultivating patience.
Yeah, sometimes sitting through difficulties can be the best experience of practice. So it's to be expected that sitting is going to be and meditating is going to be difficult at times. And it makes me think about times when I was meditating, practicing during periods of retreat that were difficult, where I was trying to do longer hours of sitting. And especially in the afternoon, and there can be some drowsiness from the mealtime, and it might be a little bit warm, and that can cause some drowsiness, some sleepiness, and or other hindrances to arise. The mind can get a little bit restless, and or we might have back pain or knee pain or any other of the various pains that can arise in the body. And sometimes we might just feel like we're out of energy. And so depending on what stage of life we're at, or where how our body is doing, we might have a little bit more or a little bit less energy. So sometimes we might have that feeling of like moving through quicksand type feeling, like there's not much gas in the tank, there's not much energy. And I think one of the things we can do to encourage ourselves to have patience in those times is to actually get interested, actually start to get interested in what that experience is like. And it makes me think of the previous king of Thailand, the ninth king of Thailand. He would do paintings sometimes. And there's one painting he did, which is kind of unusual. And he painted it while he had a high fever. So he had a high fever one time. And normally, when you have a fever, you would want to lie down and rest. But he said he wanted to do a painting while he had a fever just because he was curious to look at it when he no longer had his fever and kind of reflect on whatever mental state he might have been in when he had a fever. So similar with the meditation, when we're tired or there's various difficulties arising, to see if we can actually get interested in we don't even really have to find where they're coming from or why they're arising, but just to get interested in what is the actual experience of that. And if it's difficult, then usually we can learn something from it. And meditation is certainly not always easy. Most of the time it's a struggle to meditate because the mind, most of the time, especially if we haven't meditated much, or we might not have a consistent daily meditation practice, or even if we do have a daily meditation practice, it's going to be a struggle most of the time. And then sometimes we might have some good experiences while we're meditating. And it's kind of like if we work, we don't get paid every day, but we get paid on payday. And so we might think, well, I'm only going to work on payday then. But then we don't get paid very much. So we do have to put in the work. And we do have to experience not getting paid most of the time. And then but if we put in a lot of work, if we put in overtime, we'll get a bigger paycheck. So, at this experience, a story I like to tell sometimes is we do these meditation retreats in India, in Bodh Gaya, under the Bodhi tree with my friend and teacher, Ajahn Achalo. And two of the sessions that I was able to join with him, they were 6 weeks of meditating 10 hours a day, sitting 10 hours a day at the Bodhi tree. And this is with a lot of noise, a lot of people around, and sometimes hot weather, sometimes rain, a lot of external and internal hindrances coming up. And found about week 5 There's this real sense that enough, don't want to meditate anymore. And this feeling of just walking through concrete. There's no walking through quicksand. There's no energy. So, how to bring up energy when there is no energy? And we both kind of experienced the same thing at the same time. So, we were in this guest house. It's maybe a 10-minute walk to the Bodhi tree. And the Bodhi tree complex opens at 5 a.m. and it closes at 9 p.m. So to meditate for 10 hours, you have to be there at specific times. You can't just get your hours outside of those times. They close the gates. So we got up one morning, it's at 4:30 a.m. and we both just wanted to go back to bed and thinking, okay, how are we going to do this? So it's more just trudging out there. And my feeling was that I was just going to sit down and it was just going to be drudgery for the whole day. And I was feeling really physically and mentally and emotionally exhausted. And so just feeling, okay, I just want to not focus on a meditation object and just take it easy today. But there was a certain quota of hours we were going for, so pretty much had to do it no matter what. So get out there and then just kind of sat down and And then it was really good. Because, and I reflected on that, and that's when it got really good, actually. Because that's when I was in uncharted territory. So I had meditated a lot, and some of it was good, some of it was difficult. But at that point, I had this feeling like, I'm good. I meditated enough. And then when I meditated more, then that's when it was better than what I had known before. I knew it was a different experience. So, not that it was necessarily especially profound, but the energy came back and the interest came back, and then it was a new experience. So, I think that shows that sometimes if we run up against difficulties, it's not what we think it's going to be. If we actually face them, then that really the cultivation of patience comes when we stand up in the face of those difficulties and we actually go through them rather than give up. And sometimes it's good to stop meditating if our knees are going to be injured or if we're sick or something like that. We don't want to push in a, say, in the way that's actually going to bring harm to ourselves. But if we push at the right time, say if we're exhausted and we think, I'm just going to try to do this, then it can be really good, actually. And then after that, the energy really came back. I was thinking I'm gonna have to sleep for days to get over this, but actually it was fine. It was fine. The energy came back. It was more just getting to that edge of uncharted territory of how much I was meditating. Because I normally don't sit that much. I do more walking meditation, but at the Bodhi tree we were making a determination to actually do a lot of sitting, and found I was able to do it. I was able to do things I didn't think I was able to do, and I didn't injure myself, and it was really good. I felt like I got more patient after doing that, and then was able to. I call this I have a term for this, entering the mandala. So it's like you're entering a gate, and it's kind of difficult to push the gate open, but once you push it open, you go into a new experience. But there is that difficulty that comes at first when we're pushing the gate open. So I think with cultivation of patience, yeah, a lot of it is just there has to be a courageous aspect to it. Not in terms of like too much of a not too militaristic, but courageous in terms of being willing to go into a new experience and being willing to get interested in what it's going to be like. Another aspect of that was Kalyanamitta, because I wouldn't have done that if I was on my own. I wouldn't have done it if it, and Ajahnachalo probably wouldn't have done it if he was on his own. He probably would have rested. But because we were encouraging each other, we both went out and we both did that. And yeah, that's spiritual friendship. So it can be helpful to actually have friends in giving you encouragement. And that's the whole reason for coming into a group and meditating as a group and, you know, encouraging each other in that way. So the cultivation of patience, a lot of it is that sense of courageousness and having good friends who are going to encourage you. What comes to mind. The question over here.
Thank you. Oh, just a short mention before my question. Ajahn Amaro, I think, was in the Bay Area in September, October, or November, and mentioned spiritual friendship. I've been reflecting on that a lot because I actually hadn't heard that term. My question is this. I hope I can clearly communicate it. Faith. It's not about belief, but it's trust. And if we're going to test that faith is working, how do you know when it's working?
Yeah, faith or satta, it has to be balanced by panya, by wisdom. So faith in Buddhism has to be balanced by discernment. So it's inevitable that some of it is going to be blind belief. Some of it is going to be trust that is not yet verified. But then when in the teachings, when someone reaches the level of sotapanna, or the first stage of awakening, then you have what's called confirmed faith. Or confirmed trust. So testing the faith really happens all the time. So sometimes we might have doubts in the power of Buddha Dhamma Sangha. We might have doubts in the power of our practice. And we might experience things in our practice that put an end to those doubts. So that's when the faith starts to get confirmed. So even if it's not, say, level of sotapanna, various things will happen, like what I was just speaking about with the 5 week mark meditating at the Bodhi tree, where I was actually, you know, doubting my own abilities, doubting myself, doubting whether it was going to be beneficial or not to keep meditating. And then that experience of just pushing through and then having confirmed confidence in the practice. So we can't really test it in a willful way or in a intentional way. It gets tested on its own through the course of the practice. So when you keep precepts, so say for example, the Buddha said keeping the five precepts cuts out a whole bunch of suffering from our lives. So we can intellectually, we can understand that, yeah, not killing, we're not going to experience any of the suffering involved with killing. Not stealing, we're not going to experience any of the suffering involved with stealing things, and so on. But then when we keep the precepts for a long time, then we really start to see how much it creates a foundation for our spiritual life and for our practice. So that's when faith also starts to get confirmed. It's, you'll think, yes, I made the right decision by keeping the precepts for that long period of time. Or, yes, I made the right decision by practicing generosity. Yes, I made the right decision by cultivating patience. I made the right decision by cultivating a daily meditation practice for myself. So when you have that feeling, yes, I made the right decision. Yes, this is correct. Yes. So those, now I'm repeating Ajahn Jayasaro a little bit because he said, yeah, those yes moments is one way he talked about faith during his visit here. And that's how faith gets strong. It gets both confirmed and it becomes stronger. On an even higher level, I know a teaching that Ajahn Pasano would talk about from time to time is that there's these two aspects of faith and wisdom. Wisdom is something we really develop over time, wisdom and discernment, contemplating the Four Noble Truths, contemplating impermanence, doing all these practices recommended by the Buddha. But then there's a point where we need faith to be able to make it further in the practice. So the way Ajahn Pasano would put it, which I really like and appreciate, is he would say, it's like you're walking to the edge of a cliff, and say, over the cliff is the Dhamma. Wisdom can take you to the edge, but it's faith that jumps off. So, because you're going into something, you can't know the experience unless you just go for it. You can't know the Dhamma before knowing the Dhamma. You have to actually just jump. You have to make the leap. So that on a higher level, faith is a necessary quality for that you have to have enough trust to fall backwards into the Buddha, and know and have enough trust that you're going to be caught. So the faith actually has to be quite high to be able to do that. And that comes through long-term practice. Those little yes moments, confirmation of the faith over and over again. And then at a certain point, you'll have enough confidence that you'll say, oh, this is it. And you'll make the leap.
Thank you. Earlier, you mentioned different kinds of minds that come to the practice, anger, greed, the thinking mind. Can't remember the fourth one, but the thinking mind, that sounds really familiar. Could you talk on how a thinking mind can approach practice, what they need and need to avoid?
So that was when I was talking about different temperaments, probably. Yeah, there's a greed type, anger type, there's thinking type. That's called the in Pali, like the greed type is the raga charitta, the anger type is the dosa charitta, the thinking type is the vitaka charitta. So thinking, scientific, gaining a lot of joy from problem solving. And thinking things through, thinking things out. That's a vitaka charitta. So that's, I believe, the antidote for that is anapanasati. That is just do a real focus on the breath is for the thinking type. So that you can actually cool down, as Ajahn Sona likes to say, cool down the frontal lobe. Just thinking and planning, and just cool, imagine that cooling down with the breath meditation. So if there's a lot of thinking, then anapanasati. There's also the moha charitta, which is the delusion type. And the Buddha says that for the delusion type, the best thing is to stay close to a teacher. And having stayed close to a teacher, they can be guided clearly, because they're not going to know what's the best thing for themselves, and they need to be guided by a teacher, and then they can gain benefit. And for the vitaka charitta, it's the anapanasati. So to actually focus, there's also, for say the greed type and the anger type, there is positive sides of those types. So for the greed type, if they can transform their greed, they become the saddha charit, or the faith type. And if the anger type can transform it, I'm not sure if there's another type for them, but if they can transform it, then it can become very, very strong wisdom. If the judgmental angry mind can be flipped over and transformed, it can be cutting and penetrating wisdom. And if the greed is transformed, it can become very, very powerful faith. So for the thinking type, then the Anapanasati, just cooling it down and calming it down, and then allowing the trying to get into a state where the breath is in the forefront and the thinking takes a back seat. So the thinking will still be there. Thinking will still very much be there, but it's just bubbling away in the background. And like Tanajan Jeff translates the one of the translations of, I believe it's asava or kilesa, is fermentations, which I used to think was a pretty strange translation. But actually, it makes sense if you think of something fermenting as bubbling. It's bubbling away in the background. So, really trying to get into the feeling, because with the thinking type, also, we're up in our heads a lot. And to try to get back into the body and actually feel the breath, feel the body as well, do some body awareness. Rajan Sachito would say that for those of us who think a lot, we're like disembodied heads. So we're just like, we're up in our head and doing a lot of thinking. And then there's this body being pulled along by our head. Yeah, I would recommend just getting back into the body, into the breath.
Ajahn, I wanted to see if I could just to follow up on the last question. The four types, could you explain delusional type? Are you talking the same as ignorance of the Dhamma, or is there a different bent to that?
Delusion is, and again, we have all of us will have all of these types, but there'll be one that's more prominent than the others. Like I've never been able to figure out if I'm a greed or an anger type because I felt like I had a lot of both. But for delusion, usually the understanding is they fall easily into confusion and doubt, not sure what's the right practice, not able to stick with a single practice. Jumping around a lot, and also sometimes developing some strange ideas about how they need to practice, or strange ideas about what needs to be done. And interestingly, it's said that Ajahn Chah tended towards that, towards being that type. And so it's not that there's no hope if you're a delusion type. One quality of a delusion type as well is that, if you've ever known somebody who can get really, really angry, but it's like gone all of a sudden, and then go really, really greedy, and then it's gone all of a sudden, that's a quality of the delusion type. Whereas like a real anger type will get angry, and they're angry for a really long time, like really angry, and can keep it going for a really long time. But the delusion type, it's more like it can swing back and forth very wildly. And so yeah, we have even people who are ordained, we have all these types. And, but yeah, the delusion type, it's helpful if they have very specific teachings that they can be following. And they so I know with Ajahn Chah, he used his teachings from Ajahn Mun, and he spent time with with Ajahn Kinnari and Ajahn Tongrat, and those were very formative years for him. He was able to receive encouragement from those teachers, and because of that, he was able to find what worked for him.
Just the word greed type, I'm kind of clinging to.
I'm a greed type.
I think one of the confusing things for me that confuses me about myself is I like to give things, but if it's not, so for instance, bringing flowers to the altar, if it's going to sit there and rot during the week and no one's going to enjoy them, I want to take them back and give them to somebody else. I don't really know what that is, and when I was in Nepal and they were like at the burial place putting their jewels and leaves and sending them down the river, I love that people were in the river grabbing them, but if they tipped and the jewels fell to the ground, I mean the bottom of the water, I would I don't like that, you know. And I don't really know what that is and how to give without expectation.
No, the example of the flowers, I think that's just wisdom, just wanting the flowers to not rot and wanting fresh flowers to be on the shrine. So, but yeah, I mean, and greed, you know, again, the greed type taken to a positive way, it can become the faith type also. So, and greed types can be very generous and very want everything to be nice and clean, and that's the anger type might be more interest more keen on wearing torn up robes and having everything dirty, and so so yeah, it's not a bad thing, but then you have to look how much you're suffering over it. So for example, an anger type, I mean, all the types can have greed and anger and whatnot, but like an anger type might get angry when somebody irritates them. A greed type will get angry when our desire is frustrated. So we want something, and then it gets frustrated. We can't have what we want. So, you know, the flowers on the shrine rot. We don't want that. So we get frustrated. We want new flowers to be on the shrine. Or we want to get some sort of, we have an expectation we're going to get some good food at the mealtime. And then that food, you know, maybe somebody told us they're bringing pizza and then they don't show up. So we get upset about that because we had that expectation. It's like a frustrated desire. So each type has its own thing that it can get frustrated over. But like the jewels in the river, I mean, that's just, you can just reflect on that. It's, I don't know if it, you know, I'd be able to say whether it's exactly greed or what it is, but just noting that those things affect us in that way, and we can reflect on our experience. Ajahnamurobe told me I was a greed type, and he said, "Takes one to know one."
What would be the antidote to procrastination? Is it patience?
Procrastination.
Yeah. Is it patience or is it more generating energy?
Well, I think with procrastination, you're being too patient. So maybe energy is better. Partly too, it's reflecting on, because I've had this issue with procrastination and kind of putting things off. Death contemplation can be really helpful for that. And so if it's in terms of practice, if we're procrastinating in terms of the practice, then actually reflecting that, well, the Buddha taught that we could die soon, we could die in an hour, we could die in a day, in a month, or many years from now, we don't know when it's going to happen. But if it's something in terms of cultivating wholesome qualities, we do need to convince ourselves to act as soon as we have the intention to do some sort of good. It's important to act right away, or else we miss the opportunity. It's like having Ajahn Jayasaro come here on Thursday. You know, we planned that one day before. And so when we saw that there was an opening, we acted immediately, and then it happened. And it was amazing. But if we didn't act in that moment, if we procrastinated, it wouldn't have happened at all, and we would have completely missed the opportunity. So procrastination can cause us to, if we reflect on the drawbacks of procrastination, procrastination can cause us to completely lose the opportunity. It's not that we're going to get it done and then get the fruits. We're just not going to get it done. And we can reflect, we have to do it now, or else it's just not going to happen. So it's good to, as soon as we have the intention to do something wholesome, to really do it immediately and not lose that opportunity. If it's in terms of some sort of work, you know, you talk about schoolwork, you know, oh, I can just make it, I'll just do tomorrow's homework and the next day's homework. I'll do it all the next day. But then you develop that habit and you're just never going to get it done. So at a certain point, it's going to build up too much and you're not going to be able to do almost any of it. But if we develop that habit of consistent effort, if we develop the habit of consistent effort, we will be successful. And people who procrastinate too much tend to not be successful. So the most successful people, they end up being able to put a consistent effort into whatever work they need to do. And also, when they put a consistent effort into the work they need to do, then they are able to build on that and do it better, and then do it better and better, and then do things like wake up early and get a head start. So it's the opposite of procrastinating. So instead of procrastinating, you're getting a head start, and then you have all this open time. And then you can start to do great things when you have all the open time. When you get ahead, you actually get ahead rather than always being behind due to procrastinating. So if we procrastinate, we're just always going to be behind. We're never going to be caught up. And so it has many drawbacks. But I suppose in some ways we want to procrastinate because if we want to do something unwholesome, we should procrastinate. So we should put that off. So if we decide we're gonna, tell somebody off or we're going to activate a lawsuit against somebody, maybe we should just wait and think about it for a bit before we do it. So if it's unwholesome, we should procrastinate. But if it's wholesome, we should do it right away and jump on that opportunity.
Hello, Ajahn. I have two questions. In the morning, you describe about irritation. You gave a story where even monks in the monastery would get irritated over how the other monk was eating lettuce, right? And then you mentioned that one can train to a point where you don't feel that irritation. So my first question is, can you describe more details about how one can train or what certain things one can practice? And then my second question is, on your story about when you went to India and have a 6 week long meditation retreat, you mentioned that by the 5th week, when you push through, you can feel that the meditation is better. I wanted to ask what qualities about that meditation constitute as being better? And how I guess, in other words, how do you know that, oh, you're improving in the path? Yeah, that's a question.
Yeah, with the first question, the irritation, you can get to a point where you're not actually as irritated. And it's not that the irritation doesn't arise. A lot of the times it arises, but we learn how to reflect on it and we learn how to not act on it. So there's various practices and reflections we can do. The main one is really seeing the suffering of the irritation, seeing that it's not actually the person eating the lettuce that's making me suffer. It's my reaction to the person eating the lettuce that's making me suffer. And when we live together, it's inevitable that we're going to notice each other's mannerisms and quirks and little irritating things that we do. And that's harkens back to the question of it, family members or people who are closest to you end up being the most irritating, or you bump heads with them the most. So it's no different in community. When you're living with people, you start to notice little faults here and there and quirks and whatnot. And so that's a very good training because then we can watch. Well, one of the reflections is, well, we're not robots. So what do we expect? We're only human, and humans have quirks and twitches and mannerisms. And that's just natural. So one is you develop this attitude. When you reflect that way, you develop this very forgiving attitude of, yeah, that's fine. And I have my own stuff I probably don't notice or see. And They're going to be noticing that and getting irritated about it, and so it's not just them irritating me. I'm probably irritating them as well. So to reflect like that and say, well, if I'm doing the same things and I might not be aware of it, and they might not be aware of the that they're even doing the things I'm getting irritated by, then it's better just to say, accept them as they are. What? And then sometimes we can verbalize it. We can say, I want them to not do that twitch so I can be happy. So actually verbalize it. I want that person to not have that habit that they've maybe had since they were a child so that I can feel better. So if you verbalize it in that way, it sounds ridiculous, but that's what we're actually doing. That's what we're actually doing. We're actually getting irritated because we think they should be different. They shouldn't do that. It shouldn't be this way. So if we verbalize it, that can be very, very helpful. So there's the seeing the suffering of it and the verbalizing it in that way, and that can really help the mind to say, oh yeah, right. That can pretty easily be let go of, actually. That's the development of wisdom. In terms of the 5 weeks of meditation, I would say the reason it was interesting was not necessarily because of the exact experience of the meditation after the energy and inspiration came back. It was more that just the insight was that sitting and meditating, even though I really didn't want to and really didn't feel like it and was completely out of energy, actually pushing through that revealed that it wasn't actually the case, that it was just a mental hindrance. It wasn't actually something physical that was happening. It was a mental block, a mental hindrance that when meditating, it could be passed through. But I wouldn't have known that unless I would have actually done that at that time. And then there's a sense of very strong clarity that arises from that. So it's like an experience of clarity and also an insight that, oh yeah, it was an illusion that I was in quicksand. It seemed the mind is very, it's an insight into how powerful the mind is. The mind is powerful enough to make us think we're physically exhausted when we're actually not. And it was just a hindrance. So just pushing through that, and then it was, oh, right, that was just a mental block. That was a mental wall. But that type of practice was necessary to see that more clearly.
So the practice you were talking about of kind of verbalizing what the mind's kind of needing from the person is really helpful. I'm finding it challenging to learn how to work with kind of developing an understanding of how I create a self. So that kind of technique is really helpful because I find really the main time I see that is when I'm in a close relationship, and that's kind of bringing that for me. But I'm curious if there, once I've kind of verbalized it, even internally, if there's a way to practice with the kind of insight that's coming up and the wisdom that's coming up once I've seen it clearly.
If we're trying to gain insight into the me, or the sense of self, that is very, very subtle. So it can be difficult to gain insight into that. That's something that more comes with a lot of time, a lot of experience, a lot of practice. There's certain key times when the me and mine can be highlighted in a very clear way. So these times will be, say, when we either have a near-death experience or a near miss, a near accident, we almost get in a car accident, and we think, I almost died. And then the me comes up really strongly in those instances, or times when maybe we get criticized, perhaps unjustly. And when we get criticized, then we think, how could they think that of me? And the me comes up very clearly. So there are certain key times that we have to be on the lookout for when we are going to be able to see the me much more clearly. Most of the time, it's remaining very, very hidden, and it's linked with delusion. Delusion is the absence of a true acknowledgement of not me, not mine. Delusion and ignorance are very linked. So when somebody asked Ajahn Chah, you know, I can see greed, I can see anger, but I can't see delusion. And Ajahn Chah said, you're riding a horse and asking, where's the horse? So delusion is, it's what we're acting from. That's, and me and mine is what we're acting from. That's why it's so hard to see, because it is the horse that we're riding that we're looking around and saying, you know, where is it? Where is it? And then with mindfulness, if we end up looking very closely, when you look very closely, it's not there because it was never there to begin with. So it's something that's happening. The me and mine gets fabricated in an illusory way. And the Buddha talked about this as a conjurer's trick, and it's a very good conjurer's trick. But if we look closely enough and we meditate enough and have enough mindfulness, when we look, then there's actually nothing there. And it's really the act of not looking that creates it. So the act of not looking is what creates, is what makes the conjurer's trick successful. The act of not looking clearly, not looking closely, or not seeing closely enough with enough detail that makes the magician's trick seem real. So me and mine is very much like that. And we just have to kind of keep that in mind. And even knowing this, it's still kind of, with a really good conjurer's trick, we're going to think, like, I've been looking closely and it still looks totally real. How do they do that? I can't figure out how they did that. That's what me and mine is like. I can't figure out why does it keep getting me? Why does it keep causing suffering? So it's, this is very subtle. I mean, this is on the ultimate level, it's only let go of at full enlightenment, the actual I am conceit. Of course, we say Sakkaya Ditti is let go of it at stream entry. So Sakkaya Ditti is the belief that this body and mind is who and what I am. It's a coarser form of self. But then the underlying belief I am is in, that's arhant level. So there's two different levels of letting go of self or seeing not, I won't say letting go of self because there is no self to begin with, but seeing not self. There's two different levels of seeing not self. Yeah. So, but it said that can't remember if it's, might have been Ajahn Jayasar, like a stream enterer, they can't, even though they still have suffering, they still have greed and anger, and they can still make mistakes and do wrong things, but they can't laud themselves and disparage others for like sort of having like views and opinions. Like they can't raise their own views and opinions up over the views and opinions of others. That's really a function of Sakkaya Ditti. So say, for example, if you meet a teacher who says, well, actually my teachings are correct and all these other teachers, they don't have it right. That's red flag. If a teacher tells you that, this is the only way to see it. You shouldn't, no, they're not telling you correctly. You shouldn't see it that way. On a certain level, yeah, like the Buddha could do that, but he didn't do it in a way that he was lauding himself and disparaging others. He's doing it in a way that much more that the way of reflection, like try this out, see for yourself.
Thank you. In seeing the lack of this self, there's relief, but at the same time, there's a emptiness and it's not joyful. It's relief, but not joyful. So at times I wonder what is the best way to live life. So I've relieved myself, but I don't know. There's something that's not, I'm not passing through. Can you help with that?
Yeah, for someone who sees not self, it's going to be joyful. It's going to be both relieving and joyful. And there is also part of the illusion is that we think that if we see not self, we're going to be somehow unmoored and not have anything really to, not really, not no constant to kind of keep us on track. And yet, what actually happens when a practitioner sees not self is they have the most unbelievable stability, because they will end up finding that it was the sense of self, the sense of me and mine, was the very thing that was causing instability. But we see it the opposite way. We see me and mine as that which causes stability. But actually, it's the letting go of me and mine that causes true stability. And the me and mine is causing the instability and the fear. You know, what if something happens to me? What if I lose my things? That's causing instability. That's causing fear and hope and everything that causes us to suffer. So there will be, for one who realizes not self, there can't be a lack of joy, because the mind is going to be very, very wholesome, and that will lead to great joy, great brightness, and great relief as well. So if there is a lack of joy, it's gone off in a certain angle that we need to just investigate it. And I used to have these experiences of meditation. Remember, I spent my third year as a monk in Thailand, and I met up with I was able to ask some questions of a great monk who visited Wat Phananachat, Lungpor Plien. He's passed away now. And I remember one day asking him, I have these experiences of stillness and seemingly absorption in my meditations, but there's no joy present. I wasn't experiencing any joy. And all he said was, you have to sit longer. He said, you're not sitting long enough. You're not practicing long enough. That's all he said. So you could try doing longer periods of practice, and you might have that, because that sense of emptiness, I don't think it's a letting go of self. It's more just, it's the preliminary stages of the mind settling down. The sense of emptiness is those preliminary stages of the mind settling down. Once the mind settles and then it settles more, then the joy can start to come up, and we can start to, it's really the art of meditation. And so having these experiences, so that's why I like to talk about Pamoja, because that's the precursor to Piti and Sukha, these factors of meditation we talk about. And Pamoja for me seems to be more of an accessible quality, and that's a very deep contentment, a very deep contentment. And it comes from cultivating wholesome mental states, and it also comes from things like generosity and patience and metta as well. So you might get to a point in your meditation where it's, sometimes you can have that sense of emptiness and it might be imperceptible and kind of subtle, but you might be imposing yourself too much on the meditation rather than just stepping aside and allowing the mind to settle in a very natural way. When we have an idea about what we want to get from the meditation, that can cause a lack of joy or keep the joy from arising. So we just had our winter retreat, and within the winter retreat, each of the monks gets 2 weeks of solitary retreat where they can be completely apart from the community for 2 weeks and just in complete solitude. Some of the monks will camp out during those times if the weather is permitting. We also do these 2 week solitary retreats in the Vasa period in the summer. We trade off doing these retreats, and then can just go down, fill our bowl with food, go back up, eat at our kuti. So for me, I really cherish those times, and had an experience of one day just being at this very nice campsite. The weather was very good. Weather was perfect. And just having my meal in solitude, having my meal out in the forest, and washing my bowl and having a cup of coffee, and then just setting the cup of coffee down, and then just feeling extremely content, and then was just didn't want to get up at all, and just sat there for 3 hours. And it wasn't like you would think of it, but it was a lot of happiness. So having experiences like that makes me think, oh, it has to happen in a very natural way. It's not like, okay, now I'm going to do it. Now I'm going to focus on the breath. And that's kind of, then we're in a way, we're kind of blocking those experiences from it. But if we have an experience where we're able to just say, okay, wow, the mind is full of gratitude right now. Okay, let's just sit with that. And then we can experience some joy.
Thank you, Ajahn. Do you have any tips on walking meditation?
Yeah, tips on walking meditation. I think it's the same. It's not separate from sitting meditation. It's really going to be the same in terms of those attitudes of allowing the mind to settle in a very natural way. And when we walk, then to walk not too fast, not too slow. It's said that we usually walk slightly slower than we would normally walk in our daily life, but not extremely slow. We don't teach to walk extremely slow in our tradition, like in slow motion. Other traditions, you know, only our tradition is right. All the other traditions. But no, in our tradition, we teach just to walk a little bit slower than you would in your daily life. And you can either clasp your hands in front of you, or you can have them at your side or behind your back, whatever is comfortable. And then just trying to get into that state of enjoying your surroundings. Gratitude is a big one. Actually thinking, oh, I'm so grateful for just the ability to even be able to meditate right now and to be in this, to be able to have these opportunities to practice. And you put yourself in a state of gratitude, and sometimes even forcing a smile could be helpful, and it can cause a wholesome mental state to arise. And then walking back and forth, and impermanence is a really good contemplation, because as you walk back and forth, especially if you're outside and you do it for an hour or more, you can start to see the shadows and the trees and the day wearing on, and that can be a reflection on impermanence. So those are a couple ideas for walking meditation, but really to largely relate to it in the same way that we relate to our sitting meditation. It's just a change of posture. But it's a bit more active. We have our eyes open, so that less likely to doze off, and but more likely to think more, so we have to be careful. Maybe we can end with some chanting, and we could do the Ovada Padimokkha, because I mentioned that one earlier, and then we'll do the verses of sharing and aspiration.